Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 15th, 2019. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Scott Janisch, co-founder of Sapwood Cellars and author of The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor, gives us some tips on hazy beer stability. How do we keep those delicious hop flavors and aromas as long as possible? If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other basic brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint and our brewing rainbow shirt. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you'd do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment there, they tell us that that will help new listeners to find us. Who they is, I don't know. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And many thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. In fact, this past week, financial supporters got a rare early release of an audio episode. I produced the episode with Mike Tonsmeyer that was posted to the public this past week. I produced it about a week early because of traveling with family and friends. So I went ahead and I said, well, I'll post it to Patreon and to legacy supporters. And they got to see that or hear it several days before it went live. Also, this past Monday, I posted a video episode along with a separate behind-the-scenes video of Steve brewing his Ozark Amber at his shop, stevesbrewshop.com. So, I hope you all enjoy the extra stuff. And again, thanks very much for subscribing. Well, you know, I've been talking about this pseudo sati beer that I've been planning. I got inspired by reading Viking Age Brew, The Craft of Brewing Sati by Mika Leitinen. Well, life has been getting in the way in one way or the other, and I haven't brewed it yet, but it's on the agenda for this week. In fact, I interviewed Mika a couple days ago for an upcoming episode, and he gave me some advice that should make my life easier, so I'm grateful for that. Check out Viking Age Brew, by the way. It's a fascinating read, especially if you're interested in sort of obscure historical brewing. For that brew, that pseudo-sati brew, I have in hand, well, not actually in hand, it's in the fridge, but my pouch of A44 Kviking from our friends and sponsors Imperial Organic Yeast. It's not the yeast traditionally used in Finland for sati. They use Finnish baker's yeast mostly. But Mika says that he himself uses Kvaik yeast for the style. Kviking is a seasonal yeast from Imperial that is a blend of three Kvaik strains that can produce an insane amount of pineapple, guava, and other exotic tropical fruit aromas, they say. Kviking thrives in hot fermentations when big, complex ester profiles are desired. A low pitch rate can be used to drive these aromatics even higher, but Imperial says you should combine that low pitch rate with high fermentation temperature. So it sounds like a perfect summer yeast. You can use this blend for anything from new school hazy beers to traditional farmhouse brews. And since it's a blend, Casey at Imperial says the character may evolve from repitch to repitch if you use it again and again. I can't wait to taste what it does to my pseudo-sati. Pseudo-sati, not pseudo-sati. Kviking is a seasonal offering, so ask your local homebrew store for A44 Kviking from our friends at Imperial Organic Yeast. Very exciting stuff. One of the techniques that Finnish sati brewers use is to use long, extended step mashes. They'll spend a couple of hours, in fact, at each rest step and then wind up at the end of the mash at around 80 Celsius or 176 degrees Fahrenheit. And they use sort of hollowed out log to do this. It looks like a canoe with kind of the ends cut off. I can imagine that would be challenging, just using infusions of hot or boiling water to raise the mash to those steps. But you know what I'll be using? My electric brewing system from our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. I have the 120-volt 10-gallon system with the Warthog controller that has no problem in reaching and maintaining mash rest temperatures. Now, for this 5-gallon batch of Sati, I'll be using more than 25 pounds of grain. But I'll be using my recirculating pump that came with the system to sparge constantly during the mash. Now, this Sati is a raw ale, or it can be, which means I won't have to boil. But if I did, the Warthog controller has a mash mode and a boil mode, so not only can I depend on my mash temperature being rock solid, I can dial in the power to the boil so I can maintain the boil vigor that I like. Brewing with electricity has me spoiled. It has definitely taken the pain out of propane. High Gravity has systems from 5 gallons to 2 barrels, single, dual, and 3-vessel configurations. Whether you're looking to step up your home game or even go pro, High Gravity can help you out. In fact, they're using a High Gravity electric system for their tasting room, Pippin's Tap Room, there at High Gravity. If you go to highgravitybrew.com and use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric brewing purchase. That's family-owned and operated, highgravitybrew.com. Okay, let's talk to Scott Janish about how to keep our hazy, hoppy beers tasting fresh and delicious as long as possible. Scott Janish, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. I had Mike Tonsmeyer on not too long ago, and, you know, it's becoming the Sapwood Cellars show. which there are worse things to be, I guess.
Yeah. No, he's been on a number of times, right?
Oh, yeah, we go way back. And I think he's in the background making more beer while you're here talking to me, and you'll switch places in a little bit, right?
Yep. Right now he's munching on some lunch, checking in the mash tun. Hopefully he doesn't drop any food in there, but
you got to put it on the label if he does, right?
Yeah, that's right. We got to get some TTP approval, I think.
Ham sandwich imperial stout.
Yeah. That's what we're doing. We're doing an imperial stout today. It's a take on what Mike's been doing for years at home, a Brett imperial stout that will age in some local barrels for about a year and then bottle them off. So it'll be a fun beer.
Wow. Now Brett tends to eat a bit more of the sugars than standard yeast. So is that right, or do you have to accommodate for that if you're making a big old imperial stout with Brett?
Yeah, it'll definitely eat more. I think Mike brought in a couple bottles the other day, and the last one he did is the one that added Brett, I think, finished around like 10, 15, 10, 20, and then the one without was about 10, 40.
Wow.
But he did add stop the fermentation on that after about 3 months, I believe, with the Brett. But so yeah, it's going to be a big old beer, but it should be fun. A little funk and a little fruity funk from Brett C goes pretty well with a imperial stout like that. I almost got a little bit of like a grape funky popsicle thing in his sample. So
wow,
it'll be a fun beer. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're not here to talk about big robust stouts. You literally wrote the book on the new IPA. The name of the book is The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor. And it's all about these hoppy, hazy beers that are ruining the craft beer market, right?
Yeah, ruining the craft beer market. I think they're putting a jolt into the craft brewing market. Yeah, it's a super popular style. It's one that I've kind of been obsessed with for about 2 or 3 years. And it's just one that... you know, there was a lot of talk about what was happening with these, but not a lot of people that really understood them. And so it just seemed like a good opportunity for me to really dive into it and more so understand it for myself and for Mike, so we could hopefully improve our beers.
Of course, I'm kidding about them ruining craft beer.
Yeah, I know.
I'm trolling the trolls, as it were.
That's, That's okay. I'm okay with that.
Now, these hazy hoppy styles haven't been around very long. Is there a lot of information out there about from the scientific side about what's going on?
Just as of late, there's been a few pretty good studies, more so looking at what's causing the haze. But really, they're not in the last 5 or 10 years has there been a lot of papers or research on the style specifically, and that's mainly because it really wasn't around. So I kind of had to do my best to look at studies, over the past basically 30 to 50 years and sort of piece it together to see what the science says as a whole, and how it might relate to the style.
And you spent most of the book in talking about how to get those characteristics that are desirable into your beer. But the chapter that we want to talk about today is how to keep those desirable characteristics in your beer, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's hazy IPAs are just one of those styles that are super sensitive to oxygen. They're just one that if you're not taking precautions during packaging, you can really they'll just go downhill very quickly, which can be really frustrating to someone that's spending their entire Saturday brewing a hazy IPA, and then they package it and see it turn brown and lose all their bright tropical hop flavors in about a week. So
yeah, and you did a good job of explaining, I'm not from a chemistry background. I took high school chemistry, but that was 30 some odd years ago, and Mr. Duncan's teachings didn't really hit the high points as far as this topic is concerned.
Well, I'm with you there. I just didn't take it with Mr. Duncan, but my day job before was doing politics stuff in D.C., so we're on the same page there.
Well, there you go. In looking at, you mentioned oxygen, and that is the main enemy in the freshness of beer. But you also said that you explained that there are some accomplices that make the damage from oxygen possible, and those are trace metals, right? And how do they work together?
Yeah, well, oxygen just on its own is a pretty bad thing to get into beer, and that's not just hazy IPAs. But when oxygen is combined with some of these trace metals, particularly iron, copper, and more recently studied manganese, it can really accelerate the oxidation in these beers. Manganese is well, I guess I should go back. Most of the copper and iron is removed just through fermentation for the most part. You can lose some to trub, the yeast, but when it comes to manganese, it actually sticks around a lot longer. So I think for hazy IPAs in general, that's one of the more problematic metals.
And these metals, they react with oxygen to sort of radicalize it. This is more along the chemistry lines, but they enable oxygen to do actually more damage than oxygen itself.
Yeah, oxygen has to be converted to a radical activated form, and then it can react with other species in beer. And that's that activation is caused by the metals with the oxygen. That's kind of a lot of the research. You can go further back to understand that. I mean, that's not a new finding, but it just trying to understand why these beers go downhill so quickly is why it's helpful to kind of look back at some of the basic knowledge of beer oxidation.
So when I hear iron and copper, I don't know so much about manganese, but I've got a copper chiller, and I might have some fittings that have some copper in it. Is that where the copper's coming from? Where are all these metals coming from?
Yeah, you can get some from your brewing equipment, from the grains themselves, have minerals. I actually did an experiment in the book as it relates to copper, but this was more for, there's a chapter on hop thiols. And thiols are a sulfur compound in hops that have a very low taste threshold. But so that means that you don't need a lot of a thiol to taste it and make a difference in beer. But they're in very small amounts in hops. But copper actually can absorb these thiols. So I did an experiment with a copper chiller and sent it actually to a wine lab in France. That's where most of the thiol research is taking place. And this was just to see how much copper might be absorbing some of those thiols. And the answer came back, not a lot. So I think you're pretty safe with your copper chiller in terms of getting rid of thiols. But there's other ways to sort of quench some of the metals that you're might be adding into your beer throughout the process. What was most interesting to me, and we've actually changed some of our process here at Sapwood, is adding some mash hops to almost all of our beers, especially the hazy hoppy beers. Process of adding alpha acids and beta acids actually complexes some of those metals early on, almost right away when you're adding them. So it doesn't take much either. We just do a little bit of we take a little bit away from our 60-minute addition, and we'll add them to our mash almost right away. In fact, the higher the pH of your mash, the more effective the hop acids are at complexing some of these metals. So if you can even add them before you adjust for your mash pH, that might help a little more at complexing some of these. And again, the more you can get out, the better for long-term stability.
So the assertion that mash hops are a waste of hops, it turns out that there's a good reason to use them.
Yeah, I mean, I always joke too, if nothing else, it smells really good while you're mashing in, right? But yeah, and like, we're not using a lot. I mean, so we'll just, for a 10-barrel batch, we might throw a pound or two in the mash.
And you're talking about layering your hops through the process, adding some in the mash because of the changes in pH. And I guess, does temperature have a role in that as well?
Temperature, not as much that I'm familiar with. At least I don't recall that in the research. It was more more the pH. And then, of course, the more you're adding some alpha acids, the more those can start getting to work complexing some of those metals. So that's why if you're adding a little in the mash, a little at 60, and then, you know, towards the end of the boil or just the whirlpool, you should be doing a pretty good job of trying to limit those.
And you also talk about the role that that dry hopping has in oxidation. And, you know, with these styles of beers, you know, you would think that people are using a lot of dry hops to get those, you know, fresh, juicy flavors and aromas. But how does dry hopping affect oxidation? Where does that come into the picture?
That dry hopping, it plays more of a role with manganese again. And I guess we could get a little more detail about that with some of the grains too. But hops themselves have metals, and manganese is one of them. The research I could find on a handful of hops showed that Columbus was one that had some of the highest levels, and Galaxy was one that had some of the lowest. But again, that can just accelerate oxidation. The pickup from manganese during dry hopping peaks at about 5 to 7 days. And the warmer the dry hop, the more you'll get. So cooler and shorter duration dry hops can be a little better. To put it in practice, here at Sapwood, we do about 2 to 3 day dry hops, and almost all of them we're doing at like 58 degrees or even lower. We occasionally will do a small charge at the very tail end of fermentation, but almost all of our dry hops are coming post-fermentation and relatively cool.
And that's about 58 degrees Fahrenheit is around 15 Celsius. For those with the more sane method of measuring temperature.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote the whole book, and I had to go through and add that to each Fahrenheit that I added, which ended up being quite a few.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, thanks, Google. It made it helpful.
But it's appreciated. Yeah. So this knowledge, I would assume, has changed the way that you address hops. Are you choosing hops that have lower levels of manganese, and you're hopping cooler and shorter dry hopping?
Yeah, we don't look to, because there's only been the one study that I could find on manganese content, and I don't know if that's more of just, you know, the field conditions of a certain lot, but for the most part, the American fruitier Pacific Northwest varieties are on the lower end. So, you know, Citra, Mosaic. Those kind of hops are what we're dry hopping with mostly anyways. But we will take precaution to dry hop shorter and cooler. And that also has a lot to do with trying to avoid hop creep as well. Mm. And that's a whole nother topic that we could get into in more detail. But that's another reason we go on the cooler end on dry hopping.
So these trace metals are some of the bad guys, you know, some of the accomplices that help oxygen do its dirty work. But there are some good guys on the other side, right? That help with stability, and you know those I believe, if my notes are correct, are sulfites and protein derived thiols. Is that right?
Yeah, sulfites are created just naturally in fermentation, and those are sort of like the first source of protection from oxygen. But when those get used up, there's been some recent research that shows that protein-derived thiols actually can act as another source of protection from oxidation. And this is one of those chapters where I sort of had to tie together papers and sort of theorize some concepts, and I would love people much smarter than me to put it to the test and prove me wrong or prove me right. I'm happy either way. But one study showed that these protein derived thiols, specifically a protein called LTP1, which is usually studied for head retention, was correlated to better stability in aged beers. Which is pretty interesting, and those proteins are generally in the under-modified grains that you would get from like a chip malt or a carapils, which is something we're adding to our hazy beers anyways for head retention, but it might be playing a role in preserving them.
And these beers are hazy, so you know, one would think, hey, they're full of protein, so they should be more stable, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it not every protein is equal. I've done some studies and done some, or I haven't done the studies. I've done some experiments and read some studies on how different types of proteins can affect things like haze. And, you know, your haze levels can impact flavors. And, of course, the haze levels can impact stability. So we generally try to shoot for beers that, you know, we don't try to make anything hazy, but we definitely don't try to make anything turbid. That's, in my opinion, where you start to get into beers that if it looks really, really turbid in the glass, almost always, at least to me, it's going to taste extremely astringent, green, almost like you're drinking a dry hops sample that's sitting on hops. And that will kind of die down with time. I mean, a couple weeks, you can lose a little bit of that hop bite. We actually fine a lot of our hoppy beers with biofine. It doesn't clear them up, but it helps sort of speed along that process of peaking a heavily hopped beer. But there's so many variables in when it comes to beer in general, but especially hazy beers.
So what are, you mentioned under modified malts. What are some other decisions that we can make when we're developing our grain bills to help us with stability on the other end of the process?
Mike and I have been brewing these for quite a while, and on the commercial scale now, we've pretty much settled on avoid it. We don't use a lot of, I guess I'll kind of jump around here, but we mentioned manganese before. Flaked oats is a grain that has a lot of manganese. I did an experiment in the book where I had a beer tested that was made with 30 to 40% flaked oats. I'd have to go back and look for sure. And it came back at about one part per million manganese, and typically you want about 0.2 or lower. And so that's a lot of these hazy beers are using flaked oats, but it turns out that if you use a malted variety, you'll actually lower that manganese content quite a bit. So for Grist here, we're using almost all naked malted oats now instead of flaked oats, especially in beers that we're going to be packaging and canning. And with that, we'll usually go about 10% or so, and then 10% malted wheat. The proteins in malted wheat are more modified and will likely stay in suspension longer and interact with polyphenols, and can actually increase your haze a little bit. So we'll go about 10% with malted wheat, and then if it's a double IPA, we'll cut our two row with some Pils malt just to kind of lighten it up a little bit. We found that bigger beers, the more malt you throw at it, just the maltier they get. So we try to lighten it up for those bigger beers. And then we'll go about 10% chip malt, or if you can't get chip, you can use something like Carapils. So that's usually our grain bill that we settle on for a lot of these hazy hoppy beers. And we've been pretty fortunate that we haven't had any stability issues with these. So there's other post brewing things that we precautions we take too that go a long ways towards keeping oxygen out.
And one would assume that if flaked grains are not the best thing in the world for preserving beer, that putting say flour in your beer would be along those lines too, right?
Yep, exactly. In fact, the experiment I did in the book with manganese was, I believe, flaked oats and spelt flour. And I did my best to not have that beer come in contact with any oxygen. I did closed keg transfers. And after about 3 weeks, it was already noticeably going downhill.
What about crystal malts?
Crystal malts too. It can also accelerate aging in beer in general, but definitely in hazy hoppy beers. We don't use a lot of them. Some of the breweries I talked to in the book, they still use crystal malt, but generally they're staying under about 5% or so, and they're not having any issues with stability at those levels. And generally, the more crystal malt you're adding to a beer that you're looking for big, bright, intense hop character, and it can kind of compete with that a little bit. So we generally try to keep the malt character low and then just let the hops shine.
Now, you talked about things to do post-brewing into the packaging and such as that, and keeping oxygen away from the beer. At all times, seems like a common sense thing to do. But you have some opinions especially in the homebrew level of kegging versus bottling.
Yeah, unfortunately, if you're bottling the style, I think you're just at a disadvantage. If you're forced to do that, I think it's best to re-yeast the beer at bottling. To try to get quick re-fermentation in the bottle to try to consume some of the oxygen that inevitably will get in at bottling. You can go through greater lengths. You can. I know when I bottle sour beers at home, I'll bottle them through a tap system. Even if you don't have a kegerator and all that, you could still just use a bottle from a corny and a picnic tap. And so you're at least doing everything in a closed environment. And then, of course, if you're using The crown liners on caps themselves are intended to absorb oxygen, but at the same time, they're absorbing hop compounds. So you're going to lose quite a bit of hop aromatics from a crown liner. But actually, in my opinion, it's the ones you don't want in the beer anyways. These are the more volatile sesquiterpene hydrocarbons. So they're like the myrcene. The more greener flavors will actually condense in that cap, which is pretty interesting. But it's just, you're going to have a hazy, heavily dry hop beer sitting at room temperature for a week or 2 weeks, and I just not a good thing for the style. So I think kegging is really where it's at for the style. And I should say oxygen in general, the smaller the batch size, the more I think you need to worry about post fermentation oxygen being introduced. I mean, if we get a little bit of oxygen introduced in our 300 gallon tank, it's absorbed, it's diluted so much by the beer. But if you're getting that same amount in a 5 gallon batch, it does that much more damage. So I'm not trying to scare everyone here, but it's just, the more you can do closed transfers, the more you can purge your kegs multiple times before using them. If you can even purge the lines before you transfer beer into them, all that can make a difference.
And I have a personal example here that I want to get your feedback on that I think I can predict what that feedback will be. But I have this fermenter, this plastic, conical fermenter. I'm not going to mention the brand, but they're are a few of fermenters out there on the homebrew scale that work on the same line, that you have this container that you attach to the bottom of the fermenter, the bottom of the cone. And the theory is that, after fermentation, you can open a valve, collect trub in that container, shut the valve, get rid of the trub, and then, repeat that until all the trub is gone, and then you can put, you can keg right out of the, or bottle right out of the bottom of that conical fermenter, and isn't that easy? A whole lot easier than racking. Well,
yeah.
I noticed that, I could put like a quart size mason jar on the bottom of this fermenter, and then I collect the trub, and I sanitize the jar, and I put it back under, and then I open the valve, and then it's like bloop. There's a quart's worth of air, going up through the fermented beer. I corresponded with the manufacturer of this device, and they said, open the valve more slowly, and that way the air won't, it'll trickle the air into the beer. As far as, it seems to me, number one, that shouldn't make a difference whether the quart of air goes through the beer slowly or fast.
Yeah, it does the same amount of damage, probably, right?
But the fact that I'm having to do this, if I got a bunch of trub in an all grain Brunabag beer, I could potentially, put 3 or 4 quarts of air through my fermented beer. So that's not a good thing, is it?
No, that doesn't sound good, especially post fermentation, where there's going to be no scrubbing of it. It's tricky. I feel like you're at such an advantage when you have commercial grade tanks and equipment. I know that some of the newer fermenters for homebrewers are more similar to what we have here. So you have like tri-clamp fittings and things like that with your cone. So you can actually hook up CO2 and purge that, in your case, purge that mason jar or whatever with CO2 before opening that valve for beer to come through. That's a tricky one. I have at home, I have I just bought like an air gun that you would use, you'd hook up to an air compressor, and I have one of, on my CO2, I just have it running, one of the valves running to that. So I can basically just with a trigger shoot CO2 into whatever I'm doing. So in that case, I would just blast it into that bottle for a while before I opened it up. But yeah, but that doesn't sound good. Whenever you hear blurping, it makes you nervous.
Now, I like the fermenter, the shape of it, because as opposed to a glass carboy, it's got a big open mouth at the top of it. You know, you take the lid off, and it's easy to dry hop that way. So I did a couple of hoppy beers with the blurping method, and was not satisfied with the hoppiness of them. I think they should have been just, fruity, juicy hop bombs, but they were a lot duller than I anticipated. So, I did brew, Bell's Two Hearted clone in this fermenter. And instead of doing the bloop thing, I just used a racking cane or an autosiphon to rack off the top of it into the keg, and the beer was delicious. You know, it was nice and fresh and hoppy, and it was everything I expected. So that kind of confirmed, in my mind, anecdotally, what was going on.
Yeah, that sounds like a much safer route. Anyways.
Yeah. So keeping oxygen away as much as possible, and then modifying your ingredients and modifying your process to take advantage of the good guys and minimize the bad guys. It seems like there are some solutions that you can follow that are not too difficult in improving the stability of your beer.
Yeah, I think that's accurate, and I'm sure. I mean, I'd like to think I wasn't the only homebrewer that was being disappointed with quickly oxidized hazy IPAs, but. There's definitely some things you can do to ensure a little more stability, and I don't want people to worry too much. I mean, it's not, I think homebrewers in general, and I will include myself in this, worry too much about every batch they do. But if you take precautions and you're purging everything with CO2, and if you make adjustments from previous batches too. So I mean, if you had a heavily oxidized beer, the time before, it's, maybe step back and try to figure out where the culprit was and start using some of the resources that are out there to help determine where to move forward with it.
And drink your beer fast.
actually that was one of the, in my opinion, one of the biggest misconceptions with the style is that it's one that you have to consume really quickly. A lot of the breweries that I was, the end of the book, I went through and talked to some of my favorite breweries in the country, and they laid out their process for making hazy beers, and it was almost a consensus that if these brewers, had the ability to leave some of these beers in the bright tank for a week, 2 weeks, they would do that, because they just, they take, you're throwing so many hops at them, it just takes time for that to sort of meld together, settle out, lose some of that hop burn, to really have the hop tropical flavors come through and not just have like this green sort of bite to them.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, you're running a business and you got to move those beers through the tanks at a fairly quick pace. But a lot of them say, yeah, sit on a can if it's packaged properly. 2 weeks will be better than it was the day you bought it. Wow. So consuming fresh is definitely true, but I think there's a window of where a lot of these beers peak, and I tend to think it's around a week and a half or 2 weeks after it's packaged. But then the window goes pretty quickly after that, so anything over a month. That's typically what we do here at Zappa. We try to brew our beers so they last about a month.
If they're handled properly. I mean, you can't expect to, set a six pack in the trunk of your car when it's 100 degrees outside and expect it to be nice and fresh.
Yeah, that's not gonna taste good. I've done that. I can assure you it's not gonna taste good.
Well, I haven't finished the entire book, but what I've read is very concise and well-written and easy for even me to understand. It's The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor. And at the end of every chapter, you have a list of key findings, which is kind of like the cliff notes of the chapter. which has the high points. It doesn't have all the details, but I appreciate your coming back and reinforcing, you know, the key learnings in each chapter. It's helpful. And like I say, especially for a guy like me who it's been a while since I've had science class.
No, it's same with me. And honestly, it's that the key points at the end is just helpful for me to kind of, because the book reads more like a kind of like a reference book. It's one you can just jump in and start reading any chapter. It's not like you need to start from the beginning and read through. And for me, even still, I'll go back and pull through those and look just at the key points to try to remember what I was trying to say or exactly what the research was saying. So I'm glad you thought that. And it's actually one that Brian Roth, who's one of my favorite writers and podcaster at Good Beer Hunting, read the book, and he's like, you got to summarize this stuff, man. People need a little like, all right, so what does this all mean?
Because they may be enjoying a nice, fresh, hoppy, hazy beer as they're reading.
Yeah, exactly. I hope so.
All right, Scott, I appreciate you taking the time. I'll let you get back to work with Tonsmeyer and tell him we said hey.
I will. I definitely will, and I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you, sir. Well, thanks again to Scott. There's, of course, a lot more details in the book than what we got to on the topic. If you're into brewing hazy hoppy beers, you should pick up a copy of the new IPA. Very well written and helpful. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies always coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.